My name is Mike Hardman. I'm the Director of Research and Evaluation at the Lyndon and Harry Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, a longtime and proud supporter of the Philanthropy Roundtable, and a consumer of its products, including its guidebooks, one of which is Saving America's Urban Catholic Schools, a copy of which is available, if you're interested, outside, written by Stephanie Sirocki and Christopher Levenick. The Roundtable's products are improved by your completing the surveys after every session as well, and they are this color and on your chairs, and they and we would very much appreciate if you complete that at the end of the session today. The Bradley Foundation, since its inception, has supported the creation of educational marketplaces for parents in which they can choose what they believe to be best for their children. In its early years, Bradley tried to demonstrate parental demand for more and better options in such a marketplace. As time went on, since the creation of initial programs in Milwaukee and elsewhere, Bradley's been quite keenly interested in creating more and better supply of options from which parents could choose in those marketplaces. By definition, this has meant that the foundation has been concerned with the level and quality of Catholic schools in America. We are not a Catholic foundation, but we're quite concerned, as many of you may be as well, whether Catholic or not, with boosting the level and quality of supply to include Catholic schools, of course, especially in cities in America like Milwaukee. Catholic education, however, is in crisis, and we're going to hear from four people today about their innovative ideas to help revive Catholic education, perhaps especially, though not always, in urban areas. I will introduce them to you in a minute, but first we want to see if we can present you some information to put in context what we're talking about here today. First, though, a story. I was in line at the buffet line today, where you all may have been as well. I was building my burrito, and I skipped the salad part and saw behind me was Scott Hamilton of Seton Education Partners, who we will introduce in a moment. And I just skipped the salad and started building the burrito, if that's what that was, carefully. And I thought, well, should I tell him? And I decided not to do that right away, so I just said, well, you know, how are you, Scott? Looking forward to the panel. This will be great. How are things going? He says, oh, everything's great. This will be fun. Everyone loves what we're doing. Couldn't be better. Look forward to, you know, letting Bradley know what we're up to. And I thought, well, you know, and I'm not of the colored chips that were there. I said, you know, I really probably, I better tell him. So I said, well, Scott, you remember that PowerPoint presentation that Seton did for the Philanthropy Roundtables meeting in New York on Catholic schools? I'm going to steal hook, line, and sinker some slides from that as I put things in context at the beginning. It's just pure, sheer, total, unmitigated intellectual property theft. Is that okay? Total silence. It was the most awkward, you know, buffet line I've ever been at a philanthropy roundtable event. I thought, oh, I'm in a little bit of a pickle here. I'm in trouble. So I just proceeded. And now I'm to the, like, the guacamole sour cream part. And I thought, well, I'm in. I just got to go. I put the sour cream on and said, so I assume if there's any questions anybody has of your data, I can direct it to you. And then I just walked back to my seat. He was mumbling something I don't quite recall.
I think you're forgetting that you agreed to give us a grant.
Yeah, I was. Actually, he did say that, and that's when I walked away.
Room of it, witnesses?
That's when I walked away. So according to Scott Hamilton and Seton Education Partners, whose logo remains on each slide we'll now show you, since the year 2000, 1,600 Catholic schools have closed. The main causes of these closures have been declining enrollment and rising operating costs. This is a story familiar to all of us, but we'll go over it. One of the main reasons behind the rising operating costs, as we all know, is the different staff composition of Catholic schools. Free labor was, almost free labor was relied upon for many years. The national Catholic school per pupil cost is about 60% of the national public school per pupil cost. I'm going through this more quickly than you did in New York. Catholic secondary schools have a national graduation rate of 99.1% compared to public schools' national average of 73.2%. Catholic high school graduates are more than two times as likely to earn a college degree. students attending Catholic schools are much more likely to be non-Catholic and minority than in 1970. Minority students in Catholic schools, controlling for income and background, are 42% more likely to graduate than their public school peers. So that's the data, also included in the presentation from Seton were some observations, which I will go over even more quickly. Catholic schools provide value to more than just Catholics. To put a monetary number on it, it's estimated to be $20.5 billion annually. Oh, okay. If nothing is done, less options will be available for parents, obviously, and the competition for bad public schools will not be as fierce, as strong. And there are other causes to the crisis about which we may be able to speak today. And Seton proposes, and I don't know that many here on this panel will disagree with that. In fact, it's what we're going to hear from them about. Seton proposes several potential innovations and urges that we all consider this what it is, an important time to try innovating in various ways. So to go over some various ways in which such innovations have taken place in various locales around the country, we're going to hear first today from Christine Healy, who is executive director of the Healy Philanthropic Group and of the International Education Foundation in New Jersey. Christine has long experience in this area, including most recently through, for example, WeCanDoBetterNewJersey.org, which advocates for increased school choice options in that state, and the Catholic Schools Development Corporation. We will then hear from Timothy Bush, who is founder of the Bush Firm, and of two independent Catholic schools in Southern California of some quality, and of high quality, and we'll hear from him about them.
That's some quality.
Scott Hamilton, you've met. He is a managing partner of Seton Education Partners, which studies these issues, as you have seen, and has an initiative to use, and I think we might hear more about this from Scott, has an initiative to use blended learning technologies in Catholic schools in San Francisco and potentially elsewhere. And Michael O'Neill will finish off. He is with Preferred Sands, an investment firm in Philadelphia, and he has been closely involved with the Philadelphia Schools Partnership, which urges a cooperative three-sector approach to K-12 urban education, including, of course, Catholic schools. So we'll give you each about 7 minutes, and I may follow up on my own if I feel the need to ask a question after you go. So, Christine.
Here's my view of the world. I think what we need is a 2.0 version of Catholic schools, a new and improved version, one that's better than the outdated business model that we've seen. What we know and what we tell our schools is that the Calvary is not coming in terms of dioceses and parishes bailing out schools. Therefore, as a philanthropist committed to the growth of Catholic schools, we choose to shift in around 2004 the focus of the International Education Foundation from being primarily grant-making in terms of scholarships to being fully operational as a foundation. We're now in the business of two distinct but essential tracks. One is focused on schools that are serving primarily the urban poor. The other is focused on schools, all other schools, if you will. And we think that all those other schools can learn a lot from universities and the independent schools and what they've been doing for a lot of years. So let's first look at the urban poor schools for just a minute. A hard run at the endowment level funding is really, really important. But the problem is it's just not easily scalable. So the school choice public policy solution, which I'm sure you are all very familiar with, is really the systemic viability is seen in that choice movement and public school choice. So now I find myself in the very uncharted water of advocacy in New Jersey. And along with John Erickson and some other very committed partners, last February we created, co-founded a 501c4 called We Can Do Better New Jersey. You like that name? It's dedicated to organizing what we thought was not happening, which was 100,000 Catholics through the state of New Jersey, to effect one single result, which is the passage, of a bill called the Opportunity Scholarship Act. I'm also pleased to share that recently we were able to work with the Walton Family Foundation to expand our efforts to form a C3 along with that, which we will call We Can Do Better for Kids. Getting it done in the blue state of New Jersey, no small matter, right? The time now, though, is really to push hard. There's this national momentum in school choice. I think that's huge, and we need to ride that. And as long as Governor Christie is staying in New Jersey for now, we think we have a shot. No fewer than 13 states have enacted school choice legislation in 2011, and there are 28 states, I think, that have pending legislation, which is pretty exciting. We also know that no law has been passed and sustained successfully that has not had a good, organized grassroots effort. So it's an important place to be. The OSA, if it's passed as a pilot program, will make up to 40,000 seats available in the state of New Jersey. And, you know, then that's being debated. It was moved in the Senate, and we're now struggling on the Assembly. But it will, and it's targeted to 13 failing school districts in the state. So how do we move into the grassroots area? We got the We Can Do Better New Jersey effort is kind of vast in our range, but basically what we decided to do was place what we call an OSA or an Opportunity Scholarship Act coordinator in every school in the state. So there's 380 schools. Why not start to inform and educate and move some of those folks in the schools? So we have about 160 coordinators throughout the state. We are trying to kind of build a boots on the ground infrastructure. We've circulated newsletters to about 6,000 contacts. We speak to parents at back-to-school nights. We go to Rotary meetings. We go to university settings where there are debates on the issue and speak. We also engage, believe it or not, the priest to speak on the pulpit about this. We've generated voters' guides. We've been very involved in public relation campaigns and numerous rallies throughout the state. We've had quite a few rallies in Trenton, and we show up pretty much wherever there's a good opportunity. We're also partnering with the grassroots, which is a really interesting experience. We have created connections and partnerships with the Black Ministers Council in the state, with the Latino Leadership Alliance, with the Jewish Day School folks, with individual Republican free market thinkers. When we get together, it is a motley crew and the Catholics. But the most important thing is we work really closely with the bishops and the Catholic Conference. Really important part. But we do what they cannot. If you've ever seen, this is really funny, if you've ever seen the movie The Untouchables, there's that scene in the movie where Sean Connery, you know, with his Irish brogue, says to this very naive Elliot Ness, you know, and he says, "You look, you want to go, come into Chicago and you want to take out Al Capone. The question is, what are you prepared to do?" I ask that question often. I think with the $24 million that the New Jersey Teachers Union is spending on this issue, you really have to be prepared to do something bold. And if you spend your days in Camden inner city like I do, we have an office in inner city Camden, it's a rough place, you know. And when you see these kids thriving in our Catholic schools, you just, you know, you get really, you get amazed at what you're prepared to do. So, as a part of the effort to sustain the poor urban Catholic schools in my backyard in Camden and to keep them open while the OSA is going to be passed, right, I have the privilege of chairing a board of a new model of Catholic urban education. And in this city of Camden, it was formed in 2008 when the bishop was really looking at closing these schools. And we were able to pull the five schools out of the parishes, create a separate 501c3, the five schools serve a little bit over 1,000 kids. We hired a crackerjack educator as an executive director who was a Sister of St. Joseph. We caused a bit of a ripple and paid her a fair working wage. And she oversees the five principals and a team of managers. The schools right now outperform all the publics and charters in the city. They take a standardized test that can be compared with the New Jersey Public School Test. And they serve a poor community. 97% of these kids are qualified for federal free and reduced lunch. Many people ask about converting the Catholic schools into charter schools, but with successful advocacy, I mean, I think we can have both. Our family's involved with running a charter school in Florida. You know, it's great stuff, but it's hard business. So my thing is, why dismantle these schools that are already working in the cities? What we need is more good charters, great public schools, and great Catholics. So as a funder, we have become kind of delivery system neutral in education, which I think Mike's going to talk about. Really important concept. There's some numbers that roll around in my head a lot, 25, 16, and 6. If you're a taxpayer in the state of New Jersey, you need to care, right? For a first grader to be educated for 1 year in Camden, it's $25,000 a year. If they move to a charter, it's $16,000 a year. If they're in a Catholic, it's the bargain basement price of 6. So, a lot of people want to hear that argument, and that's what Week in New Jersey is doing, telling that tale. In addition to the challenges of the urban poor schools, we also know that closing, there are these middle-income schools, and schools, Catholic schools in wealthy communities that are closing. It's really, you know, it's kind of the unspoken reality. So here we need a new model and that we can also borrow from all those best practices in the universities. And in the end, the whole deal is we have to figure out how to help schools in those communities help themselves, which is like an idea that Carnegie, I'm sure, would love. We ask ourselves, what would it look like if a foundation, right, like us, could make an investment in a school so that the school principal could hire a full-time advancement director to own two revenue drivers, enrollment and fundraising? And they own it full-time. After enrolling 10 new students into the school, the job is basically paid for, and the candy bar culture could be replaced by annual appeals and major gifts. That's what's going on now for us in the Diocese of Camden. We also, as a part of that, looked at dissolving all the advisory boards in the state and replacing those boards with boards of limited jurisdiction, expanding the role of laity, a really important component. So now we are in 28 schools in the 6 counties of South Jersey doing it, and the results have been great. We have had a 4% increase in enrollment across the board and added $1.25 million to the bottom line in the last year alone. So, just to close, in the end, we really need this kind of 2.0 version of Catholic schools as we work on all the schools, but also the advocacy work that we're doing. I have two things I always tell myself. One of them is no guts, no glory, and the other is when you pray, move your feet. So, you know, we're working really, really hard at it, and I hope that, you know, what I've shared with you is helpful in some way to you. So.
Well, thank you. Yep. Now, Christine, you didn't actually do the Irish brogue when you did that Capone thing.
If
you
I could want to do Sean, I mean, okay. If I could do it, but I would have.
How happy were the bishops to have your help? Is it bishop or bishops?
It's bishops. Bishop Galante.
Right,
yes.
Okay.
Yes,
how happy was he to have your help?
And he had no choice.
Yeah, you know what? The thing is, you know, it's like crisis is the greatest opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we met, they were reorganizing schools. They closed 30% of their schools. Bishop Galante faced closing 50% of the parishes. It was a very dark moment. So we did come in at that moment, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, timing is everything.
Okay.
Yeah.
How were disagreements handled, if there were any? Or how would they be if there are?
You know, the truth is, this is what I spent probably 3 years almost working on the commission when they were reorganizing, and they had to get to know me, you know? It's all about people. Change is really face-to-face people trusting people. So when we came in, you know, I remember we were creating these boards of limited jurisdiction, we're completely new. And she said, you are not going to make our diocese an experimental, you know, lab rat for that moment. But you know, you just have to keep hanging in there.
How long did it take to build the relationship where they had the trust? Because if someone's out there wanting to jump in tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, well, it took me 2 years on that commission. I think when all these dioceses across the country are looking at reorganizing their schools and parishes, when that moment happens, you just have to, as a layperson, be a part of it. Yeah.
And then were the 160 coordinators volunteer, or were they paid too?
So in South Jersey and Camden, all of them are paid because they are the advancement directors. So the people that we hired as advancement directors are the coordinators. In all the other areas, what they are volunteers in the school, but in many of the schools we have two and three deep. They are like our captains, and they have to have somebody replace them if they can't do it. So when you use volunteers, you have to have three. When they're paid, you can have one. Yeah.
Okay. What well, will come back? That's expensive, isn't it?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, I mean, we have this whole program going in Diocese of Camden. It's expensive, but that's, you know, that's a part of sustainable schools and the investment in that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Tim Bush.
Okay, well, the model I'm going to talk about is completely different. So, and that's what the beauty of this panel is and the beauty of what's going on in Catholic education. When you look at a top line of 1.6 million schools closing, that is mind-boggling. But it isn't take a rocket scientist to figure out there's something wrong. About 20 years ago, my kids were just starting school. I went out and my wife interviewed all of the Catholic schools. She wasn't Catholic at the time. And she came back and she says, she was a teacher, and she says, Tim, I don't know if I can send our kids to these schools. They're just run down. They don't look that great. And, you know, so I said, let me fix this. So I got out there, started looking around at the schools and found out the same. So I went to the high-end, what I would call secular schools, very nice, but there's no faith. And it was more like a country club than a school. So by providence, I ended up starting these private schools, and I learned a lot in 19 years. I didn't start them all perfect. But basically, our problem in Catholic education is over 90% of the schools are parochial, meaning they're attached to a parish, right? The other 10% of the schools were founded by private orders, the Jesuits, Servites, or whatever happens to be your order. So what's so unique about my model? The model is it's founded by laity, but recognized by the bishop as a Roman Catholic school. So that's why we call it private Roman Catholic. And what's so unique about that? Well, in our situation, we're using parents to give them ownership because they're the divinely appointed educator. Yet, what do we do about education? In the government schools, we just wrest control of education away from the parents, and we put it into the government and let them teach our kids, and we tell the parents to stay out of it unless we want their money. This is a completely opposite. Parents are on the board. Now, this is completely counter to administrators and teachers. To me, it makes a lot of sense. They're their kids. They get to listen to their kids at night saying, you know, Sister Susie or Mary, the fourth grade teacher, is not doing a good job, and they can come in and help fix it. It does have problems because you have parents that, you know, you got conflicts of interest. So you got to be very careful to monitor this. But it puts parents where they belong, overseeing and working with the school and the issues that they need. It also takes education, which is basically a socialism concept, and turns it into you have to satisfy the customer. In elementary school, you have to satisfy the parents. In high school, you got to satisfy the kids because the kids are making a decision about where they go to school. 90% of the kids in my high school, they picked the high school they went to, not their parents. Obviously, in elementary school, the parents pick the school. So you've got to please somebody. And that's the problem with education. In government schools, you go where you live. You can move and go to a better school. Many people do, but they don't really have a market-driven economy. And you've got to, by putting the parents in charge, you've got the customer trying to set the product control instead of having the faculty administrators tell you, well, that's just the way it is in education, and you can't change it. If you're going on vacation, I'm going to give you zeros for every day you're gone, even if you're taking them to Europe to have an experience, because that's our policy here at the school. It's nonsense. I mean, the parents should decide what their kids do or don't do. We have websites. We can get the homework overwards, and they can submit it by email. This is not rocket science in today's world. So why do the parochial schools don't work? Number one, they have bad facilities. Number two, they don't charge enough money. We just saw this. Well, maybe you can't charge money in an urban school, but why should the suburban schools be penalized by not charging enough? And people say, well, that's okay. In a suburban school, the people will donate the money. 95% of the people don't donate money. But if you charge them tuition, they'll pay the tuition. It's remarkable to me. One's tax deductible, the other's not, but they'll be happy to pay the tuition as long as they feel like they're getting a good product. So you've got to give them good facilities. You've got to build size. Parochial schools are 250 students maximum, meaning that you've got one teacher at the elementary level in every grade. So if you have a bad elementary school teacher in fourth grade, you're going to have a bad fourth grade experience for 20 years in that school. And how many of those teachers ever get fired? And this is not the Catholic school system. They don't hold people accountable. They don't even try to collect the tuition when it comes due. So you've got to hold people accountable. And by having a larger school, our elementary is 850, you have three fourth grade teachers. So if one teacher is maybe not so good at math or maybe not so good at another subject, you can team teach. So you have multiple teachers and you can move out teachers that aren't accountable because you got two other examples of who is a good fourth grade teacher or fifth grade teacher. So that's another thing, size. Parochial schools aren't any larger than 200, 250 students. You can't hire a decent principal. We have two parochial schools in Orange County that are very successful, and they're regional schools, chartered by the diocese, but they cover four or five parishes. The other problem you get into with parochial schools, if the pastor doesn't like education, you're out of luck. Some pastors are good at it, some aren't good at it. Why don't we just let them run the parish and let a board who has authority, not consultative authority, run the school? That's really what the private Roman Catholic model is. It's amazing, since we built our two schools, all of a sudden, the local parochial, or the local diocesan high schools and regional schools are starting to build fabulous facilities because they have to compete with us. It's the greatest thing in the world. We're now driving up the level of education for the diocesan-run schools. And the parochial schools either are going to have to merge into a regional model, or they're going to have, they're going to go out of business. So, what do we charge for tuition? Still less than the private schools, but we're charging in the average of $12,000 to $15,000 a year. Not $6,000 or $7,000. 100% of our operating expenses are covered by tuition. We do not rely on fundraising for it. We figure out what it costs, and we charge what it costs. Fundraising is for capital, for debt, for endowment. However, 15% of our students are on financial aid. Nobody gets a free ride. Nobody. I don't care what they make. Nobody gets a free ride. That's entitlement, and we started that the first couple of years. It was a train wreck. People were, you know, damaging the school, not taking care of the books. So everybody, I don't care if they're a gardener, they come in with molded up $20 bills and they pay part of that tuition. We give outright grants for up to 50% of the tuition, and then they can qualify through other programs. People, we find that affluent neighbors whose kids are going to school with somebody else see somebody need help, they will help them, but they won't necessarily help somebody that they don't know. So this is a great model where you get less affluent kids in, and maybe they can't pay the sport fees. Well, one of the parents, Johnny, will come home and say, you know, Tommy, my friend, his parents don't have a job and they can't pay the sport fees. All of a sudden, the other parent helps out. Joy and love is created. So these have been a successful model. It's 850 in the elementary, and we have 1,050 in the high school. And we're just happy. I know there's a lot of them. Thanks.
Where does the financial aid come from? You fundraise for that?
We do, both. The elementary school, we all financial aid is funded by out of the tuition, so it's tuition discounts like universities do. In high school, it's about 60% tuition discount, 40% raised, fundraised.
Okay. How hard did you have to work to get the Catholic label? And if you could describe that process, if someone might be interested in.
Well, amazingly, our bishop was very open to it. The first bishop I was under was totally against it. The second bishop that came in was much more progressive thinking, and you have to work with them. You have to be, you know, understand their situation. But now that the mold's there, a lot of bishops are using our affiliation agreement throughout the country because it's been approved by another bishop.
How long did that take?
It took about, from application, maybe a year and a half. The first time I created the school, I tried to get it approved, couldn't, so I just created it in accordance with the Catholic tradition. But that has its problems. Catholic identity is so critical to these schools. 41% of our students are non-Catholic, but you still need some benchmark, and Catholic identity is what they're looking for.
I get it. It's parent-driven. Have you ever fired any parents or suspended any parents, or law firms fire their clients sometimes?
Yeah, no, and yes, we have. But amazingly, we have a nominating committee, supervised parents, and you know, I had an incident last week. We sit down with parents, we give them chances and read the Riot Act to them, and we've, at the elementary school, I think we've probably fired five parents, but the high school, I haven't had to fire anybody yet.
Okay. Where do those kids go, just out of curiosity? Other Catholic schools?
Generally, they would go to other Catholic schools, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is where a parent, in the elementary school, you get parents that are so over-involved that, you know, their kid can do no wrong, and then pretty soon you realize you got nothing to do. In high school, it doesn't happen that way as often.
Thank you. Scott Hamilton.
Thank you. When I was a kid, I always wanted to be a weatherman. So I'm so excited that I've got a screen here and I can point to the high pressure system that's coming in. I hope you indulge me just by letting me stand. No. This works. What do I put? Do I point it at you?
Yes, but no, I don't know. Point it at the screen. That's what I was doing.
Oh, no, but to get it to switch, sorry.
Oh, all right, sorry.
I'm a Luddite. I'm not going to be talking about a high-tech school model. I'm a Luddite. Thank you.
If you want me to do it.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
He was that way in the
line,
too.
All right, so too. The model I'm going to talk about is bringing the blended learning, high-tech approach to education we heard about a little bit in the plenary session to a Catholic school. And that's what this is about. Blended learning. Because this is new, and because it's sort of become hip, that means there are a lot of different words that people are using to say the hybrid model, the high-tech model. Blended learning is the one that I think makes the most sense, but I thought we'd just sort of talk about what that means quickly. Instruction on the computer in the core subject, not just computers in the classroom and you send kids over to do a little bit of something on it, but the core academic instruction. And for me, it's 25 to 50% of their time, their instructional time, is on the computer. And it can be done with a computer lab where the kids go and spend a portion of their day in a computer lab, which is sort of the rocket ship model, or what we're doing, computers in the classroom. And in either case, kids are spending time with a live teacher or teaching assistant, and then also some time on the computers. And there is kind of an unfathomable amount of data that is then available to teachers about how their students are doing. It used to be, in general, in a traditional school model, you have data once or twice a year from standardized tests, and sometimes teachers look at that data. Here we have data every day and every week about how many of your third graders are getting long division and doing well with that. You get that data. So there's just a massive amount of information about how your kids are doing. What's so good about this is it's not that it's hip or popular or a cool thing to talk about, but that it can do these three things. It can drive down per pupil costs, and that's a huge challenge right now in Catholic education writ large. It's boosting enrollment, and that too is a huge, huge problem that we've got in Catholic education. And the problem that we don't talk about quite so often is that we're also suffering on learning as well. Our scores and our results in terms of academic achievement aren't as good as they used to be when most of our teachers were nuns. We're suffering. And using this approach to learning, I think, is going to substantially boost what we're doing in terms of academic achievement. So the three goals of our FEDRIS initiative: improve and increase student learning, and it's through individualizing and differentiating that learning, both with the human teacher and with the computer. And again, increasing learning through these two different, through that individualization, and it's also about maximizing relationships. If we talk about kids spending half their day on the computer, well, how are you increasing relationships? I promise you, by having the kids spend time with the teacher in smaller groups, and the teacher knowing much more about how each student is doing, is maximizing their relationship with that student and how they can help that individual student. And it's substantially reducing the per pupil cost and increasing the operational efficiency by increasing enrollment and class size. You had a Seton slide that showed the big thing that everyone talks about in the change in Catholic education, that's the loss of the nuns. It was a super, super economic boost to our schools that we had to pay room and board for some fantastic teachers, by and large. But one thing that doesn't get talked about is the change that we've also adopted while we've lost the nuns, and that's that we bought into this idea that small class size is a really important thing. So we've got Catholic school classrooms all over America that were built to have 40 kids in the classroom, because the economics really used to sing. Because you used to have the nun, who was paid room and board, in a class of 40 kids. Today we have the expensive lay teacher with a class of 20, 22 kids. This is helping us boost class size, and we've got the classrooms to do it, and it makes great educational sense. Here's what a FEDRIS classroom is looking like in the Mission District in a Catholic school in San Francisco. You've got desks, and three-quarters of the classroom is going to look very familiar to you, and then we've got the computer lab in the other third of the classroom. And the kids rotate between those two places every half an hour or so. Half the class is on the computer, while half the class is with the teacher or teaching assistant. Then after half an hour, they switch. This is just what it looks like graphically. Those are the kids in that one-third of the classroom. And here from the vantage point of the teacher working with that smaller group while the other half of the kids is on the computer stations. Key elements here for Phaedrus, what we're doing. It's easy, by the way, to go to a big textbook publisher and buy their software. And you will use Hardcore Brace for math, Hardcore Brace for language arts, Hardcore Brace for social studies. I haven't found a content provider that's good at all those things, even in the textbook area, but never mind on the digital front. So one of the key things we're using is we have a platform, so it's one sign-in for the student. They usually click the animal that they've chosen, it's them, and something else is the password. And also one sign-in for the teacher, but an array of providers. We can just choose who's the best language arts provider and use that software. We can choose who's the best math software, and we can change our mind 3 months later. And that platform allows us to do that. We're really talking about strengthening the role of the human teacher. And this, by the way, to me is a key thing for Catholic schools to take the lead on. Our Catholic school advantage for so long has been human capital, the social capital, those relationships. We should be using technology to do the same thing. And then to use this technology to tailor the instruction to the individual needs of the child. And by the way, a little bit of a surprise for me is what we found in San Francisco. This increases the demand for the school. It's a little bit tough right now to recruit kids in an urban area, in an inner city, to your Catholic school. Because if I'm making $30,000, $40,000 a year, to spend $2,000 a year for tuition versus the free public school or charter school down the way, that's kind of a tough proposition. But what we found is with poor Latino parents, poor African American parents, the idea that your kid is going to be spending 50% of their time on the computer actually sings to them. That appeals to them a lot. Well, it's about time my kid get the same kind of treatment that those advantage kids have. So we've actually been able to help the school boost enrollment. Very quickly, I'll just show you some of the numbers, and these are conservative estimates. But with them, this is two schools that merged to create this Mission Dolores Academy last year. And then as a blended model, what their budget's looking like. So they've saved $500,000 through this whole merger process in adopting the blended model. Very conservatively, I'm just saying about $50,000 of that, a little under, I can truly ascribe to a saving from the digital approach to learning. Because I'm just counting any student above 25 per classroom that they currently have. That's all I'm counting as a direct benefit from blended savings. But they've increased enrollment and done some other things that's actually helping that revenue line as well. Next year, when we're going to get the enrollment in a class size to 35, or it's 27 right now, but 35 next year, we're going to have helped the school save $1 million in their operating cost and direct blended learning savings of over $300,000. Given the state of the economic crisis with most Catholic schools, we think this kind of approach can do a lot. And by the way, the terrific thing for me with this school is this year, their per pupil cost, operational cost, is $8,000 per student. That's down from $15,000 per student last year. Next year, it's going to be $6,000 per student, and that's really close to what they're charging for tuition. Now, 70% of the kids are on some sort of form of tuition assistance, but wow, what a great thing to have tuition pretty close to what your actual per-pupil operating cost is. So thank you.
Thank you. So who is your customer? A school? A diocese? An order? To whom do you make these presentations? Bishops, diocesan officials, principals?
Yes.
All of the above?
Yes.
Who's your biggest customer now?
Well, the Mission Dolores Academy is an independent Catholic school. It was the merger of a parochial school and an independent Catholic school, and I am very glad that it is an independent board that is overseeing the school rather than the traditional arrangement.
And
but this any school can do this.
Right, okay. What I didn't, there's a lot of people out there, as you noted, providing blended learning or online curricula.
Not a lot, but a number, more than one. Yeah.
People are selling.
Yes.
What makes yours Catholic, or is it not the curriculum that's Catholic, it's something else?
Charges less.
The curriculum is not Catholic. I haven't seen good Catholic math. Actually, as far as I can tell, in some parishes, in some dioceses, Catholic math isn't working
very well. It's the Trinity.
The Trinity I've got, okay. Yeah, if you can count to three. But
you could sell this to school districts.
Oh, absolutely.
But
the great advantage we have with Catholic schools, by the way, I mean, outside of New York and some other places, we're not unionized. So I got to interview every teacher at the two schools that were going to merge, and it helped the principal assess who was going to be good using this blended model. They had to buy in to this blended, doing this changed learning environment. And it's the toughest change here. The kids love it. The parents love it. It's a big change for the teachers. They're still getting used to it, and it's November. They're getting used to it. They love it, but it's change.
Yeah. Am I getting theology, religion on the computer in the same way? Someone must provide content for homeschool. I don't know.
I have not. I want to create. I don't have time, but I want to create a great online.
We have online
CCD.
We have online religion.
I'd like it to be adaptive. For I mean, we're doing K-8. This is K-8, so I can't get Good Shepherd online very well, and it wouldn't make any sense to do it. But I feel like there's some good things in terms of knowledge and content that we could do online. The best thing I can tell you about our experience so far at Mission Dolores, as I said, the parents love it, the kids love it, the teachers are really warming to it and are pretty enthusiastic about it, but they've got one nun at Mission Dolores, who, as far as I can tell, was sent by Central Casting when you ask for a nun, Sister Anne. She's a Dominican nun, and she's in charge of religious education at the school. And she's in her late 60s. And I said, okay, Sister Anne, what do you think? Kids are spending half their day on the computer. What's your assessment so far? And she just looked at me and sort of stood up a little straighter and said, oh, Scott, it's fantastic. So when I know that I have that gray-haired nun enthusiastic about the kids spending half their day on the computer, I'm rested. God is still in the building, and she's still doing her work, and the relationships are stronger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How come all nuns are from Central Casting? There's no peripheral casting. Michael O'Neill.
Great. Quick background. I ran an organization called Blocks in Philadelphia, Business Leader Organized for Catholic Schools. And we did primarily two things. We raised scholarship money for kids to be able to go to Catholic schools. And then we focused on building endowments to help keep schools sustainable. And as Christine said, that's not a very sustainable model. We have about 25,000 kids in Catholic schools in the city of Philadelphia. And so a substantial number of kids. And what I would always find as a challenge, I also sat on a board of a charter school that had been on for 9 years. And I would go out to raise money, and I'd sort of try to pick and choose who I'm asking to raise the money for, depending on who I went to. And I sat in a lot of these meetings, and one thing I found about education very quickly, it's probably the most divisive subject, more so than politics, than anything I've ever seen. You don't start to discuss education, and within 10 seconds, you know where the person sitting across the table from you stands. Either they're very anti-union, what do I think of unions, the first thing you get asked, or they're very pro-union, you know, why am I pushing all these non-union schools? They don't believe Catholic schools are right because we're going to teach them all to be Catholics, and maybe the person I'm trying to raise money from is Jewish. And as I always point out to him, you know, we are there to evangelize, but the good news for you is we're not very good at it, so give me your money. I got some yeah. But it becomes very divisive right away. Charter schools, you know, believe that the public schools are trying to, you know, screw them, put them out of business. Catholic schools and charter schools are putting them out of business. And I found I spent so much time trying to explain why each model was important that I determined that there came a time when we need to focus more on how do we educate our urban city kids in a great way. And let's just make the subject very simple. Let's go create great schools in Philadelphia, and let's not worry so much about who's running them. And as you start to think about that, the sad thing facing Philadelphia and many of our cities around the country is that you start with who's doing a great job, the Catholic schools are doing a great job. And yet every year we lose dozens of Catholic schools. You know, we put kids in and we enroll them, and you go to raise scholarships for them, and a parent has to ask herself, you know, you talk about that sacrifice of am I going to spend $2,000 to go to Catholic school? It's hard enough to say I'm making $20,000, I'm going to spend $2,000. It's harder to then look the nun in the eye and say, are you going to be around by the fifth grade when my kid gets there so that they can finish school here? So we face a double challenge. So as we try to create great schools in Philadelphia, we're watching great schools disappear on the Catholic side. And so we launched a charity called the Philadelphia School Partnership. And the goal was very simple. You know, if you go back to why we all have an opinion on education, why we all have our ideologies, is because we think the people who are doing it right now are not doing a good job and could do a better job. And we've chosen one or the other to support. And so our thought is if we just go to create great schools and we support anyone who can do it, then that's a model that we can support. And through that model, we will see the value of Catholic education because they do a great job, and we'll put the ideology aside. And so we started out by trying to get, I had a bold goal. The goal was to build a partnership between the city, the school district, the charter schools, the archdiocese, and the governor of Pennsylvania, the Chamber of Commerce, and our whole philanthropic community. Because the first thing I felt we had to change was we had to take ownership of our schools. You know, you read the articles in the newspapers criticizing any one of the schools that we have, and you rarely see a rebuttal, you know, from the private community saying, you know what, that's our school, we're going to go and help and fix it. You hear criticism, but you really hear us taking ownership. So the first thing we tried is change the vernacular in Philadelphia. We own our schools. If they're failing, it's our failure. Let's look in the mirror and accept it. If as Catholics we are losing our Catholic schools, we have chosen to do so. And by changing that vernacular, we decided to partner with the Gates Foundation and do what they call a Gates Compact. But we're doing it uniquely in Philadelphia, and that there's not a compact in the country. Gates is focused always on charter schools and public schools. And we said, we're going to add the Catholic schools in as part of this because we want a tri-sector approach because we desperately need our Catholic schools in Philadelphia. And we started into this. And I can tell you, we're about 2 weeks, 3 weeks away from, Mark's our director, so I'm counting Mark on this, 3 weeks away from signing that agreement. And that agreement will be signed by our governor. It will be signed by our head of our Chamber of Commerce, who has now made education their number one initiative because they've seen that there are models that work and we can put together a system that works if we look at it as a system of schools. It will be signed by our mayor, our superintendent, our new archbishop has agreed to sign it, and our charter schools have agreed to sign it. And it's a very simple concept. We've identified 45,000 kids who sit in what I call failing seats. That's a kid who sits in a seat that year in, year out, the kid in that seat is performing at 20% or below in reading and math at his grade level. So he's at 20% of where he should be at that point. We said to the city, let's agree we're going to close all those schools down, and we're going to move those kids to successful schools. And we're going to look at all the models, and we're going to choose. And by the way, that kid could be sitting in a public school or a charter school. So if he's sitting in a low-performing charter school, we're going to close low-performing charter schools because school choice is nice, but it has to be quality school choice. And so we created an index. It's a simple 1 to 10 score. And if you're a 1, 2, or 3, you can apply to grow your school and get, you know, public funds to help do that. If you're a 8, 9, or 10, and you're getting public funds, we're going to close you. And if you're in the middle, we're going to work to help you grow. And what PSP does is we're raising money to put the startup money up for these schools that come in and take over these failing children. Last year, and the year before, we took over 15,000 kids in schools that we supported. Their grade levels went up by 22% in 1 year. And I can tell you, our school district is not a very organized school district, so they didn't get those schools until August 1st. They opened up after Labor Day, and within 1 year, test scores were up 22%. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you something very good and something very sad. The very good news is our kids can learn, and we see that time and time again. We're proud of what they accomplish. What's sad is the only thing standing in the way is that we don't make it our goal. We aren't determined to go accomplish that because we have models that work and we watch them closing every day in the Catholic schools. And we have operators that are very good and we ignore it for all sorts of political and ideology reasons and we go forward. So we've now gotten these groups to get together and agree that we are going to not tolerate that anymore in Philly. We're going to close those schools. And we asked the Archdiocese to come in and sign up. And quite frankly, they're not sure really what that means. We're going through what they call a Blue Ribbon Commission right now in Philadelphia to determine what to do with our schools. And what will come out is a lot of closures, some of which have to happen because, you know, the days of having a Catholic school on every block is just not efficient anymore. But what I said to them is, please, don't do what we've done for the last 32 closings, which is the newspaper article comes out, we're closing schools because demographics have shifted and Catholics have moved, period. You have to draw a vision and a goal for where we're going with the rest of our system. Put a plan in place. You know, we've laid out a whole series of structures. At Blocks, we give them marketing grants, $15,000 per school, to go out and to go advertise their school, to go out and take referrals and build kids. We have created these Catholic college models where they move into the high school and make the high school about $500,000 a year. And we've encouraged the Archdiocese to hire a CEO, which at Blocks we said we would pay for, to create a winning model and become a partner in our city. And just in closing, our urban education model in Philadelphia and many cities cannot be successful or will be set back 20 years if we lose our Catholic schools. You've heard several models here. What I've learned about education is we need them all. And we need to work cooperatively and we need to make them successful. We have a $600 million budget deficit in Philadelphia School District. We have a $50 million Catholic school budget deficit right now. We cannot afford to continue to sit with empty buildings, half full, and duplicate resources. We have to pull together and do that, and we've created a data map in Philadelphia to map every school in the city so parents can choose and we can plan better in a strategic way, and the Archdiocese has signed on for that. So,
Thank you.
Thanks.
Were there any union people who signed the compact?
There are no union signatures on the compact. But I'll tell you, the union did agree to these conversions 2 years ago in Philadelphia, which was amazing.
What am I agreeing to if I sign the compact? There would be different responses. There'd be different ways to agree with the compact,
yes,
given who you listed. What is
first, it's a commitment to a goal. It says what the city's all about. We suffer, and every city suffers, from talent drain. You come to Philadelphia, we're seen as very regressive, so the new education reformers don't want to come to Philadelphia. So the first thing we say as a community is we're about great schools, and we're going to close our lowest performing schools, and we're going to create great schools. And so the Archdiocese on their side is saying we're focused on creating and keeping great schools. Second thing they're talking about is sharing resources. So we have some 35 empty school buildings in the city of Philadelphia, Archdiocesan. 25,000 seats sit empty. 70,000 public school seats are empty, and yet a charter school, we get a charter and go build another building to create another 1,000 empty seats. So sharing resources, working together, best practices, commitment to being great, and then working on this data map so that we do things in a rational way. If we're going to close a Catholic school, maybe you don't want to do that because we're going to close 3 public schools around you. One of the things they've just passed for the low-performing city schools in Pennsylvania is a charter bill and the increase of the EITC bill. At Blocks, we're going to try to concentrate our scholarships to go to the areas where they need those schools the most because it's a fixed school model. Keep the seats full and the school makes money.
And you must have sketched out where you're going to have a political problem first when all the seats that are being filled with the money from the collective goes to save what was a Catholic school. I mean, the politicking's not over after the signing of the compact, is it?
It's not, but here's the surprise for Catholic schools. The biggest interest we've found in our compact has been that the Catholic schools want to be a part of it. There are a lot of people who don't want to give money to Catholic schools because of the religious nature, but they love the values-based education, and as part of a total solution, they are happy to give money to it because they want to be a part of the system. We live as isolationists as Catholics, but we play a giant role in every city where we are present, and we have to start to look at that not only as Catholics and Catholic schools, but as how we play that whole role, and as part of the whole role, it becomes very clear with a $600 million deficit that we can't afford to lose our Catholic schools. We need that value-based education, and people want it. And if they have the money, they make the sacrifice to do it. As you talked about crumpled up $20 bills, we have people come in and pay tuition with a brown bag, and as the sisters always tell me, I never ask them where it came from, you know, but yeah. Crumpled up dollars to pay tuition on a weekly or twice a week basis. That's how much they sacrifice for that education.
Did you say the Catholic schools agreed to have themselves rated on the same scale and in the same way as the public?
It took a long, 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 long time.
Yeah.
But they have now agreed to it.
Really?
They have now agreed to it. And how we got them to agree to it is we asked them to put them up on a board one day, and I said, let me show you who you're competing with and how good you're going to look. You know, again, we're always on the defensive. We're always apologists. I said, show what you have up there and be proud of it. Your scores are incredible. And the Connolly Foundation, in fact, had to help me push the Archdiocese to release that. And when we put it up there, it blew people away at how good they were. And I said, these schools are going to close, and look at the neighborhood school next to it that's performing at 20% proficiency. That's where those kids are going to be stuck going.
Well, thank you. Well, like, if I can ask the first question, and it's a terrible question, because I happen to be Catholic, hopelessness is a sin, but is this enough? Is this enough to save Catholic schools, however you would define saving it? And I mean, I'm anticipating you're going to say, well, it doesn't matter if it's enough, we have to do it, but if you're a cold-hearted, maybe even non-Catholic philanthropist interested in building the supply of good schools that might be Catholic, would this be where you would look? Is it enough? Especially, I think I might be wanting to most direct this to you because, you know, you're founding two particular schools. Is it enough? Is that mere charity as opposed to strategic philanthropy? Well, can any of this save Catholic education?
Well, I'm just finishing the touches on a book, how-to book of how to create this. But in the meantime, there are a lot of private Roman Catholic schools being formed in this country as we speak. Not only in California, throughout the country. So I think it shows people it can be done. And bishops kind of go in groups. In other words, when they see one bishop being successful with it, they're going to export it to another area. So I think that private Roman Catholic schools are a wave of the future. And it's not me that's going to create them. It's going to be people out there who are inspired, who are tired of the situation that they have, and they want to turn it around. And so, yeah, I think it's scalable, but not by me particularly, by the Holy Spirit.
I think the answer is no. This isn't enough. this is all good, but we just need five other things that we're talking about and pursuing all at the same time, because the problem is big enough. We need to do different, we need to try to accomplish the same goals in a different way, find different means, and there are got to be five other ideas at least that we should all be pursuing in different ways and different places and see what works and replicate what does quickly. But we need a lot more going on, a lot of creativity and a lot of risk-taking.
What if we're not sure whether it works or not? We're not going to have 20 years' worth of data.
We don't need 20 years' worth of data.
Well, a lot of people want certainty before they make a grant, and they don't want to fail. And 20 years' worth of data might help. Is it worth moving
well,
forward without knowing?
They should not be philanthropists if they're going to wait 20 years for data.
Well, all right. You make it pretend I said 10.
You can have a year or two's worth of data and have a good...
Oh, you can't be sure on a year's worth of data. Really.
You can't be sure after, Andrew Carnegie did a great job building public libraries in America. They're kind of empty right now, and books might be on their way out. Where's the electronic part of this? There's lots of things that can change.
He wasn't as data-driven as we're all supposed to be after these conferences.
I like being data-driven, but that shouldn't prevent us from taking risks and seeing what works, evaluating it, which is a new thing for a lot of people to be doing, too.
And I think the other big component you have to have, there are lots of great ideas, we need more, but the biggest thing you have to have is the Catholic leadership in the Archdiocese has to be committed to it, creating a model that their goal is to be successful. And I can tell you, if you ask that question in Philadelphia or most cities, and I think it's about to change in our city because of the leadership, they couldn't answer that clearly. They couldn't tell you their clear goals. And any organization without clear goals is destined to shrink and fail. And then, your program is a boutique. My thing sounds nice, but I'm working with, washing away sands on a beach. We have private Catholic schools that try to open in closed archdiocesan schools, and they wouldn't sell them to them or give them to them or lend them to them. That's a lack of leadership. And so you have to have that leadership ultimately. To me, if you have that component, then all these other things pull together and coalesce to have success.
That's a very important point. I've heard that many times, that bishops and cardinals, they're very concerned about Catholic identity. But the schools that are suffering from Catholic identity are the parochial schools.
Yeah.
Cardinal Burke says that he gave up on trying to convert his own parochial schools in the Archdiocese of St. Louis. He said they don't have Catholic identity. We all know Cardinal Burke is very Catholic identity oriented. He said the schools that have Catholic identity are their independent schools, Private Roman Catholic being one of the models. But so the reason they're not giving up the real estate is because they're afraid that somebody is going to have a school that's a heresy or maybe not as Catholic as they want it. Well, it might happen, but the proof is that they're more Catholic than the parochial schools, mm-hmm. and there's nothing the bishop, whoever that bishop is, can do anything about it because they're all entrenched. You can't move the people out of the system. Even if you have a good bishop, like if you have Chaput in Philadelphia, it'll be interesting to see how does he impact his Catholic schools.
Yeah, but the thing, just quickly, inner city, you need to have choice in your city so that you don't have free right next to you. There's a reason they don't give up their bill. They've got their school. We need to get this school choice thing going. It needs to be real, and funders need to be neutral about, funding education, absolutely. And it is scalable. What we're talking about outside of inner city, if foundations decide to make, a $65,000 investment in a school, it will ultimately be able to help itself over time. That's a scalable model to me. That's not in urban poor. There's kind of two different roads.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking our panelists today.